My name is Ron Price, and I'm your AHA Governing Committee representative. Welcome to the 36th Annual American Homebrewers Association National Homebrewers Conference in Grand Rapids. I have the honor of introducing you to Candace Moon, the craft beer attorney. She's going to do a presentation on the top 10 legal mistakes startup breweries make. Candace Moon is a San Diego-based attorney who has spent the last 4 years dedicating her law practice to the craft beer industry. She currently works with more than 75 craft breweries and craft breweries in planning nationwide, handling many different legal areas, including business entity formation, alcoholic beverage law, contract review, and trademark law. Her clients include Green Flash, Drake's, and Jameel Zanishef's Heretic Brewing. Ms. Moon's undergraduate degree is from the University of Virginia, and she attended the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. She has been a member of the California State Bar since 2008 and the Brewers Association since 2009. And when I had the opportunity to introduce folks for this conference, since I'm starting up a brewery myself, I have a vast interest in what she has to say this afternoon. So I would like everyone to please give a warm welcome for Ms. Candace Moon.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to take a picture of you guys real quick because this is the biggest crowd I've gotten to speak to before. So I got to like prove that this really happened. If I can figure out how to do it. Yeah, definitely. Like, whoa. We're also having a couple of technical fixes, so I can take up a minute here. Okay. Let's see if I can fit everybody without falling off stage. Okay. Glasses up, smile, cheers. Thank you. Okay. So let's get started. So this presentation came about. I get calls from a lot of startups, a lot of people looking to open a brewery, and they just don't know where to start and don't know what to do. So much of the law is state-specific that there's not a lot of hard and fast information in here in terms of what the law is. These are just all the areas you really want to look for and watch out for and think about when you start going down this road. So, first of all, my legal disclaimer. This is not official legal advice. And you know that everyone laughs, but there's a good reason for that, because what I'm giving you is general information. And so much in the law depends on your specific circumstances. It comes down to facts and the specifics of the case virtually all the time. So that's actually not as funny as it sounds, but it's awesome. My little safekeep, my CYA. Okay, so first topic, entity choice. And there's really two pieces to this. One is, do I even need to form an entity? And that is a resounding yes. You are getting in the alcohol business. There is a lot of potential liability. You want to protect yourself, your family, and your assets. That's what an entity does. So anything that happens with your business is liable. You're not personally liable. If you don't form a business entity, it all comes back to you. And when people sue people, I'd say 95% of the time, they're suing for money. So if you have money, you want to protect it. So then the next piece is, well, what entity do I choose? Because there are a number of different forms, and this is going to depend state to state. This is something you want to talk with at least a couple of professionals on. The most common entity that are chosen by startup breweries are either LLCs, limited liability companies, or corporations. And corporations is by far the more traditional entity choice. Mainly because limited liability companies only came around, 10, 15 years ago. They're a relatively new entity, and they don't even exist in some states. They also do not exist on the federal level. So if your state does have LLCs, you're actually still going to be choosing a different way to be taxed federally. So you definitely want to make sure you're talking with a CPA about this. So the differences are, a corporation is kind of what you probably are familiar with, shareholders, people buy stock. As we heard a lot in the last election, corporations are people too. So the corporation is separate. One of the, I guess, downsides of a corporation is that your corporation is taxed and your shareholders are taxed. So you're basically taxed twice. CPAs hate corporations. But sometimes there's a good reason to be a corporation. There is a special option called an S corporation. And this is a corporation that's taxed like an LLC. And that sounds like a great option. You just have to know there's some legal ramifications to being an S corporation that are going to limit your options in terms of management and the kind of control you hold over the entity. And as well, there are a lot of legal formal requirements in a corporation. You have to do a lot of different paperwork. That basically, if you don't do this paperwork, your corporation can be found to be flawed, and therefore it does not operate as the protection that you wanted it to and why you formed it. So if you don't meet these requirements and you don't do all the paperwork you're supposed to, you can still be found liable at the end of the day. Now, an LLC, on the other hand, has some different terminology. It's still basically the same. People are called members instead of shareholders. And it has this thing called pass-through taxation. So instead of getting taxed as an entity and then shareholders getting taxed, all the profits and losses just kind of pass through the entity, and the people getting money out of the entity pay the taxes. That's what pass-through taxation means. And that's the same thing as with the S-Corp. However, in the LLC, you, at least in California, and again, this is going to be very different in every state, you can do almost whatever you want in terms of how you structure those rights of the investors. You literally can legally give your investors next to no rights if you want. And I don't know how many investors are going to want to give you a lot of money if you don't give them any rights whatsoever, but it is legally possible. You do end up having to pay self-employment tax, though, through an LLC. And some people don't like that. That's the difference. In a corporation, you're going to be a salaried employee. And again, it's not available in all states. So you definitely want to have an entity. That's true no matter what state you're in. But what entity is the right one for you really depends on what your vision is. What are you looking to do? How are you going to set this up? Are you opening a brewery by yourself, bootstrapping, no investors? Well, then it probably doesn't really matter which one you choose, because you're protected. You're protecting yourself. Are you going to go after outside investors and try and raise a lot of money, raise $3 million? Then it really does matter. And you want the input of both a CPA and an attorney, because you want the tax ramifications. But you also want to know from the legal side, what does it mean? CPAs love to recommend S corporations. And in California, and I'm sure this is probably true in a lot of states, in an S corporation, you can only have one set of rights. So all shareholders, founders, and your shareholders have the same rights. The only way you can maintain control is if you maintain a majority percentage. And that's difficult at times, especially if you have investors putting in a lot of money. So the CPAs don't always think about the other ramifications. So you do want to get input from both professionals. Okay. Now, speaking on the idea of capital raising, it is extremely easy to violate securities laws while raising capital. And by raising capital, all I'm talking about is if you take money from someone and you give them ownership interest in your company. I mean, if you're doing loans, those type of things, you know, if you're trying to raise money by giving away part of your company and calling it a loan, that's probably still securities. So if it's a semantic issue, it's still securities. But that's what we're talking about. Okay, there's state laws you have to know about. For example, and again, all my examples are going to be California, because that's what I know. In California, if you're a one-person corporation, corporations have to issue stock to officially be corporations. If you're a one-person corporation, you have to issue yourself at least one share of stock for that corporation to be officially legally formed. And you actually have to report that to the state of California. So even though it's probably not worth anything, they still want to know about it. And they are still going to charge you $25 because they're going to take their money however they can. Every state has these kind of laws. With an LLC, it's a little different, certainly for the sole member option. But when you start selling shares, ownership, equity for money, you need to file it with your state. And you also need to make sure that you adhere to their laws. So, for example, I'm going to talk about the basic federal laws that most people end up working under. So there's something called Regulation D that allows you to be exempt from registering your securities, which is what everyone wants to avoid because that is a ton of paperwork. Okay, so there's a number of different ways you can be exempt under Reg D. Okay, first one is, and I'm going to refer to by number. So 504, can advertise. And by the way, putting it on Facebook that you're trying to get investors would be considered advertising. You can do no public solicitation. You literally need to be one-on-one talking to people you know to make these offers. So no solicitation, less than $1 million total in a 12-month period. And then you can only have what they call accredited investors. So accredited investors, and this is my photographic rendition of accredited investors, make either $200,000 a year if they're single, $300,000 if they're married, have a net worth, I believe it's of half a million or a million, I can't remember off the top of my head, but basically rich people. The law's not worried that you're going to take their money and they're going to be screwed and in trouble. So the law is like, go for it. They can afford it. They probably know what they're doing, and they're not going to be harmed if something happens. So the next exception is 505. Again, no solicitation. So again, you're doing this one-on-one to people you know. In this one, you can raise up to $5 million. In a 12-month period, you can do an unlimited number of those accredited investors. And you can do up to 35 of what they call unaccredited investors. And that's grandma. Grandma who doesn't really have a lot of money and doesn't know about business, but wants to give you money because she loves you to help you start your business. And if, you know, it's $5,000, $10,000, whatever, unless she meets the accredited, which she might, mine doesn't, that's going to be your unaccredited investor. Basically, probably your friends and family are going to fall in that category unless you're really lucky. And you can have up to 35 of those people. So what I'm saying here, too, is if you have friends and family who want to invest, who don't make $200,000 or $300,000 a year or have a net value of $500,000, you can't use 504. You're going to have to go with 505 potentially. And there are exceptions to all of these, by the way. So again, superficial or high level. So 506B, it's a slight variation of 505. No solicitation. I hope I'm hammering that in. No solicitation. Unlimited amount of money you can raise. Unlimited accredited investors. Okay, now they have something called sophisticated investors. Yeah, I know, it's fun. So these are people who may be unaccredited from a financial value, but have enough business experience, knowledge, or have a representative, an attorney, a banker, a finance guy working with them, that they can make an educated decision. So that's what a lot of people end up using. Now, there's also a new one under 506 where you can advertise. And this is part of the Jobs Act, and everybody's all excited. We can advertise. We can go get that money. Unlimited amount of money, but you're back to the only accredited investors. So just be really careful of this, because this is one where people just don't, if you don't know the limitations of the exceptions, it's very easy to violate these. And the other thing you actually have to do, you don't have to register with the SEC, so you don't have to do the like big ton of paperwork. You still have to file with the SEC. So you have to file paperwork that says, I'm exempt from registering because I'm doing my sales under one of these exceptions. So there is still paperwork that has to be filed. And I see people not doing that all the time. Okay, so that was securities laws. I would highly recommend if you are raising a large amount of money, definitely work with an attorney. There's a couple of other, you know, if it's just you, you don't have to worry about it. If it's friends and family, depending on your friends and family, are they going to sue you if you lose their money? If they might, then you probably want some legal assistance. If everybody knows what they're getting into, no danger, no big deal. But when you start taking money from people that, large amounts of money that, and these are people that you know, but you may not know very well. They may be friend of a friend. You probably want to be very careful. And there are certain legal documents that that can be created that basically operate as a big CYA. Anybody not know CYA? Cover your ass. So this is a big document, and it's kind of expensive, but depending on how much money you're raising, it's very well worth it. That gives what you're going to tell people in the first five pages is every reason that you're going to lose their money. Here is everything that could go wrong, everything that makes it difficult to be successful, from I've never owned a brewery, I've never worked in a brewery, this is a very agricultural dependent business, so if there are no hops, I can't make my best beer. Anything that can go wrong. Competition, it's in a growth phase, but there are lots of other breweries opening. Because what you want is a document that when, God forbid, you open and things don't go so well and you lose somebody's $100,000 and they go, you never told me that you had to have hops and that there was a, you know, a hop shortage. You can say, oh, yes, I did. See, here, and you signed it, and sorry. You know, so they can be expensive, but they can also be very important. And again, I would gauge it on how much money you're raising. And that's where you want to think about, especially when you're putting together a business plan, how much money you're going to need to raise, and therefore how much you want to put aside to help cover your legal costs to have some of these documents created. So, okay. That's it on capital or securities. Okay, this is another big one. Entering into agreements without counsel. Now, sometimes that's okay. And if you've dealt with a lot of contracts in your former job, probably not a big deal. However, you're going to be dealing, if you start a brewery, you're going to be dealing with a lot of different contracts. And it's very easy to sign something. And then when you, you know, things don't work out and you want to get out of it, you're stuck, and especially when you get to the point of signing distribution contracts, because in some states, you're stuck for life, hence the handcuffs. So some of the different documents, the first ones you'll see when starting out are probably either a founder's agreement, an investor agreement, an operating agreement. That's the setting up the business, and you need one of those if you have co-founders. You need something in writing in place. This is... Founders agreement is your business prenup. We're marrying our business together. And God forbid something goes wrong, how do we want to get out? You want to plan that ahead of time. You don't want to have to deal with it when you haven't had anything in writing and then you're totally pissed off at each other because you figured out that you really just can't work together. So you want to, when everything's great and everyone's positive, and you can make logical business decisions, decide your worst case scenarios then. And you do, I think, want, on a founder's agreement, I'm not going to say you have to have a lawyer help you with that. I'm not going to say that. But you do want to be careful. And if you are a very risk-aversive person, you probably do want to have an attorney look at it. But those can be very short documents. Investor agreements, that's one you want to be very careful about. Those tend to be long, have lots of complicated terminology, and you just want to know what you're getting into. So sometimes you're going to need somebody to help translate the document. I mean, that's pretty much what I figure as lawyers we do. Leases, same thing. There's a handful of things specifically in a lease you want to watch out for as a brewery. And for whatever reason, the one that pops to mind is in the standard lease, there's always stuff about not puncturing the roof. You're going to have to puncture the roof. The last thing you want to do is sign a lease, not realize that you can't do it, tell the landlord, oh, I got to do it. And he's like, no. And then you're stuck. So it's always good to, if you're not familiar and uncomfortable reviewing it, have someone review it for you, preferably someone who knows breweries and knows what you're going to need to do, because your real estate guy may not know that you need to puncture the roof. Equipment purchases, that's a lot of money you're spending. You want to make sure that if things go wrong, you've got a way out, or that they're going to fix it or replace it. I've definitely known people get stuck in those and have not a lot of options. Supplier contracts these days, you got to contract for your hops ahead of time if you want to guarantee. And even then, because I had a client who had a hops contract, paid in advance, and then they didn't have the hops. So then it's like, thank God I have a contract because I have something to enforce. And you can kind of help force them to go out and get those hops for you. Employment contracts, that's down the road probably when you start hiring people. And then distribution agreements is one of the worst ones these days. The one thing I want to point out, and this is probably true of all contracts, but specifically for distribution agreements, state law will trump whatever the contract says. So I've had people be like, oh, well, my contract says I can terminate at any time. Well, guess what? The law doesn't say that. The law is going to trump. So you've got to be really careful in some of these things where if you don't know the law, you can't assume that what you put in that contract is actually going to hold up in court. I mean, hopefully most distributors would not be so cavalier as to put things in writing they know aren't enforceable, but I've run into one or two that I wouldn't be surprised. And I apologize for any distributors in the room. Did I mention I work only with breweries? Okay. So there's a ton of paperwork when opening a brewery. So you've got to register with a whole bunch of different agencies. I put federal on the left. Those are some of the California agencies on the right. Every state's going to have probably a good five agencies they're going to want you to register with. And then the other piece that actually is what trips up most people is you've got to update them. So when something changes, you need to let them know. And virtually anything on your application in the beginning that changes, you got to let them know about. So one of the things with both the TTB, the feds, and so, for example, the California ABC, is they want a lot of information about your entity and who is involved. Who are your directors? Who are your officers? Who are your shareholders that have a 10% or more? If that changes, you got to go back and tell them about it. And if you don't, you can become really, really penalized. I found out recently one of the biggest things that TTB is concerned about is money laundering. They are very, very concerned about hidden shareholders. So you can possibly pay a lot of fines. You know, I haven't seen anyone get really hammered on this yet, but it's something you just want to really be aware of. Okay, where's my technical people? I'm coming up on the video. And there is nobody who cares. Okay, you guys might not get to see my very entertaining video because I don't think we have sound. I do. Yay, thank you. Okay, excellent. Okay, so. And now, of course, I hit something weird. Oh, sorry, guys. There we go. Okay. Failure to establish an intellectual property strategy. That sounds very fancy. So let's just take these one at a time. Okay, I'm hitting the wrong button. There we go. Okay. And now I'm still, there we go. Okay. Let's see if I can make this work. Okay, so I'm going to talk about trademarks first, and I'm going to let this video do a little bit of the talking. Crush your fingers, the internet doesn't go down on us. So for anyone who can't see the screen, basically a trademark is a word, a mark, a color, a phrase, anything that represents your business as the source of a product to the consumer. And we have no volume. Well, I can start it over again, too. I'll take it back to where it's where we actually want to hear it. I promise it's going to be worth it. It's probably the best part of the whole presentation. That's what I get for trying to be all fancy. Let's see if I can move it ahead. I'm going to give it one more minute and then I'll just tell you about it. Actually, I got a better idea. Let's do it this way, since I can't get it to play in my thing.
Possible combination of words that a brewery can use to name its beer. And our industry is quickly approaching this threshold. According to the Brewers Association...
Okay. Let's go back to where he starts talking. There we go.
I'm Tom Schlafly, co-founder of the St. Louis Brewery, maker of Schlafly Beer. Do you know that today there are more breweries operating in the United States than at any point in our country's history? And each and every one of these breweries brews beers, and those beers need names. Math tells us that the English language only allows for 72,683 possible combinations of words that a brewery can use to name its beer. And our industry is quickly approaching this threshold. According to the Brewers Association, it is estimated that by 2024, every possible word combination that could be used to name a beer will already have been used. Indeed, today most of the good names have already been taken, leading to countless claims of infringement and a seemingly endless parade of cease and desist orders. But no one has felt the pain of this drought of cool beer names more directly than we have. Take our Schlafly Pale Ale, Oatmeal Stout, Kirsch or Hefeweizen. Perhaps you thought this simplistic, style-forward approach was some sort of no-nonsense naming strategy on our part. Nope, sure wasn't. All the good names had already been taken. Here at the St. Louis Brewery, we are taking this impending trademark-ageddon incredibly seriously. We didn't want to take any chances, so we decided to go straight for the jugular. We trademarked the name beer. That's right. We now have a federal trademark for the word beer. Don't ask us how we did it. I simply remind you that I am a lawyer, an actual dues-paying, card-carrying lawyer, and I am just as innovative and creative when it comes to practicing law as our brewers are in coming up with new styles of beer. Don't believe me? Just wait and try to violate our trademark. So, join us in raising a toast on this April 1st to our newly launched and federally trademarked Schlafly beer. It's not a beer unless it's a Schlafly beer, legally. Mmm! Cease and desist. More like cease and delish.
Cease and delish! I can take no credit for that because that was not, other than finding on the internet. Okay, so actually I'm going to follow up the trademark with just a couple of notes. One thing that is very important to know about trademarks, and a lot of startups have gotten screwed by this. There's only two ways that you can gain rights in a trademark. So, and let's just say a brewery name. You can either register it or use it on goods, and in this case beer, for sale. So having your entity name registered with the state, having t-shirts with your brewery name on it, having the Facebook page, having the website, none of these things give you trademark rights. And that's really hurt a bunch of people who thought that it did. Where they thought they had rights, somebody else registered it, then they tried to fight because they thought they had rights, which then kind of ticked off the other side, and they ended up having to change their name after putting in a lot of time and effort on marketing. So you want to be very, very careful when choosing your name because you want to make sure you don't infringe on anyone else's name or beer name, and unfortunately, winery, wine name, distillery, and spirit name. You are competing against all alcoholic beverages in the eyes of the trademark office. In the real world, not so much, I think. But I actually haven't seen any of those go to a final court decision, so we don't know for sure. But do your research. If you're going to Google it, that's fine, but look at all 15,000 pages. Everyone looks at like two or three pages like, oh, that's fine. Look on Beer Advocate, rate beer untapped. Look, the TTB, when you start to cross state lines, you have to file for label approval, and they have a public database. Check that database. Those are all really good places. And then, of course, the trademark office, public database. So you can do a lot of research on your own to see if anyone else is using. And remember, it's a same or similar mark. And when you're trying to run the gamut of what's similar, just put yourself in their shoes. If you had your name first, and then they opened with that name, would it bother you? And if it will bother you, it's probably going to bother them. So just kind of keep those in mind. And when you do, the time to trademark a name, by the way, is when you're invested. So if you are emotionally invested in a name, so you're not planning to open a brewery for 2 years, but you have a name and you love it and nobody has it, register it now. You have, by the from the time you register, you'll have about 3.5 years to use it. Now, you do have to use it, what they call, in commerce. You have to cross state lines. But unless you live in Colorado, shipping to GABF is crossing state lines. Shipping to World Beer Cup, crossing state lines. It's very easy to cross state lines. The other investment is a financial investment. So I tell a lot of breweries, you know, until you're slapping it on bottles and shipping it across the country, you may or may not want to trademark a beer name. It really just depends because it is expensive. There's no question about that. Which kind of leads me on to copyright. So copyright's another option sometimes. If you have a very artistic logo, you can copyright that sometimes instead of trademarking it. The key to copyright is it has to have a minimal level of creativity. So for example, Apple couldn't copyright their Apple logo. It's just too simple. It's an Apple. You can use it as a trademark because it represents their business. But you can't copyright something that's really basic and simple. It has to be fairly artistic. But some people have very artistic logos. And copywriting is a lot cheaper, and it's better protection. With trademarks, you have to pick by class of goods. So in other words, what you pick for beer, someone else can use that same name for faucets. And I say faucets because Delta is my favorite example of airlines, faucets. Two people can have the same name. People aren't confused. You don't think the airline makes your faucets. So, but in copyright, you own that on everything. So if someone were to use it on faucets, you could stop them. You also want to be careful about accidentally infringing someone else's copyright. And that usually happens on websites, Facebook pages, and that kind of thing. Especially photographs. You got to be very careful about the photographs you put on your website. Just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's free. Some things will be, But some things don't. And there are companies out there who've made a business of trolling websites to find unlicensed artwork and photographs. Mainly because copyright has what they call statutory damages. So basically, if you're guilty, you're paying. There's no, like, the jury is involved in finding guilt, but how much you pay is set in stone, and it can be as much as $30,000, which is why the whole Napster thing was such a big deal when it was going on. So you want to be very careful about accidentally infringing someone else's copyright. And then if you have things that you want to copyright. So I think of Stone, for example. A lot of their copy on their bottles is really unique. You can copyright that. You can copyright text, not like a phrase. You would trademark a phrase, but you can copyright paragraphs, copyright artwork. Again, copyrights are very inexpensive. I don't file a lot for my clients. I'm more concerned about accidentally infringing someone else's copyright. So I've done some logos where it's been pretty unique, but otherwise, good to know about. And be careful, especially the photographs. That's where they get everybody. The last thing, and it's funny, I always thought this would be a big deal in the brewing industry, is trade secrets. If you want to protect a recipe, trade secret is the only way to protect a recipe in terms of intellectual property. Coca-Cola being the most famous trade secret. Really, all you have to do to protect a trade secret is keep it a secret. Seriously. You have to take measures. So, like, you have people sign confidentiality agreements. You don't tell people what the recipe is. You don't publish it. You don't leave it lying around. You don't let everyone and their brother know what it is. If you want to protect it. However, I have found that brewers pretty much believe that, you know, nobody can take my recipe and make my beer. It's me. I'm what's important. So I have done very little trade secret work. But, I mean, big breweries somehow manage to be pretty consistent when putting out certain beers, which leads me to believe that there's definitely a recipe involved there. So just something to think about. Not an issue in the beer world right now, but something to be aware of. And actually, you know, one thing I would bring up for you guys is that if any of you go to work for a brewery, and let's say you are an award-winning home brewer, basically, if you're going to brew that beer for this brewery, make them pay you for it. Get something out of it. And vice versa, if you have a brewery and you're bringing on this home brewer, you know, and you want, half of why you're bringing them on is for their reputation and their name and their beers, you need to make sure that it's in your contract with them that you own that or that you've bought it from them. And you certainly want to make sure it's in your contract that whatever beers they brew while working for you belong to you, the brewery. Again, I haven't really seen this burn anyone yet, but I would say as the industry is getting bigger, you've got more people getting into it who aren't necessarily brewers. You've got a lot of guys with money who think this is kind of a cool thing to do. They open a brewery and hire a brewer. I'm not sure they're all going to have the same kind of craft culture that that I know I've become used to. So it'll be interesting. Okay, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide because I am horrible about numbers. If you are not a numbers person, hire a bookkeeper. You need to keep your numbers straight. You need to start with them correct. Keep track of the money coming in. Keep track of the money going out because you've got a lot of people looking over your shoulder that want to make sure they get their money, such as the TTB, the IRS, your state excise tax board, your employees. You need to make sure you pay them. Your shareholders are going to have the right to come look at your books. You need to have your books correct. If nothing else, you know, maybe hire a consultant to come in and set you up. Set you up in QuickBooks, give you some quick training. I mean, believe me, I work with a lot of startups, and they want to do everything themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you can do it yourself. I can't. I screwed my QuickBooks up in like 3 months. So I'm not good with numbers, which is why I'm a lawyer, not a CPA. Insurance. Make sure you think about insurance. Get the right insurance. There's a lot, and there's actually a lot of people. The insurance companies have realized there's opportunities, and they've put together brewery-specific packages because there are things you're going to need that a normal small startup business wouldn't. So these are just some of the different options. There's some things you're going to want in the beginning, and other things you may not need till you're a year in, 2 years in, and just it's one of those things you want to find a good broker that you trust. And then stay in touch with that person and update them as you go on. And as you grow, there's going to be different things you need. But just a general liability policy is probably not enough in the beginning. I'll tell you that much. Okay, this is another big one. Now, granted, until you have employees, it is so easy to violate employment laws. Mainly because, for one thing, they're different in every single state. That's another fun thing. And they're different on the federal level. I had one client who I found out was paying people the federal minimum wage, which was unfortunate since that was actually lower than the state minimum wage. You've got to know what you're doing. It's very easy to misclassify people. What's the difference between an employee and an independent contractor? It's not just how you pay them. There's actually rules of how you decide what kind of person this is and how you have to pay them. Wage and hour. Is someone hourly or salary? In California, it's very specific. You have to meet certain requirements to put someone on salary. Are you giving meal and rest breaks? That's a huge issue that I know that the feds are really hitting the restaurant industry on right now, which means that the brewing industry is right behind. And then a really big one for you guys, in my mind, is OSHA and making sure that you're safety compliant, that you've got the injury illness prevention plan, and that you're basically doing everything you can and should to be as safe as you can. And I found that I thought it was interesting. There's just a lot of little regulations you do have to worry about, because what tends to happen is it's not the big things that anyone did wrong. It's, you know, an accident happens, and there's no fault. Nothing was done wrong, but because the feds come in, they then find like the 18 other little tiny things that are wrong. No one's gotten hurt, but then you've got a big fine and a big problem. So you do want to be very careful, and you have to do a ton of record keeping with employees. And again, this is all going to be very different depending on your state. So you either need to find, and actually there are a lot of HR companies that'll do this for you. My recommendation on this, because I know there are payroll companies that also do HR, be very careful when you're choosing. I would not use a payroll company that's not based in my state for HR. I had someone get burned by that as well. The headquarters for their payroll company was in Florida. They were violating California laws on their paychecks right and left. Because you have to report certain things, you have to show certain things, you have to be paid by a certain date. And again, these are the little things that, God forbid, you have one employee who's pissed off because you let them go, and you let them go because they sucked, they didn't do anything. They find a lawyer, that lawyer's going to come in, and this is what I have found out about employment law. It's not that you're firing them, which was totally valid, it's just that thing that gets them in the door to find the 20 other little things that shouldn't have mattered, but do. And it just starts adding up and adding up and adding up. So you got to be very, very careful, and you want to be as on the ball as you can. Okay, we're getting near the end here. So it's kind of a maze. That was my visual there. There are a lot of resources available to you, and a lot are free. So don't assume, oh, I can't call a lawyer. They're going to charge me. Well, guess what? I do an hour free consultation, and I probably still do a whole lot more stuff for free. It's just what I do. It's, you know what? If I tell other service providers, if you want to work in this industry, you're going to do a lot of stuff for free. You're just going to, I mean, that's what we do. I don't think it's fair to charge people to find out if they need me. That doesn't make sense to me. But there's a lot of available resources from your professional advisors, an attorney, a CPA. I have a CPA I work with who does every first meeting for free. If you need it, a real estate broker. That can be very helpful in finding you the right location. Another, and this is not necessarily a legal mistake, but a lot of people will get in a lease, find a location, sign the lease, and then only to find out that the floor won't hold their equipment and they have to go in and pour another 7 inches of concrete. which is not necessarily a big deal, but it's not something you want to find out after you've signed the lease and you're stuck. So a broker can be very helpful in helping you find the right location. There are, at least in San Diego, we have an architect who specializes in breweries. Very helpful. Even if, and keep in mind, you don't have to hire these people for the whole thing. You literally can hire them for an hour to consult with you. And maybe that's all you need. It depends. I mean, if you're doing a tiny nano, you're probably not going to need the architect. But you know what? You might want to pay him for half an hour to come look at the space and make sure it'll work. You know, it depends on what you're doing. If you're doing a 30-barrel system, you probably want the architect. And then industry consultants. There's a lot of brewery consultants, people who will help you, kind of guide you down the road of how do I get started, what can I do. And then you have your kind of your next level service providers as well. A lot of this stuff you'll do on your own to start. And then you'll outsource. And then if you get big enough, you might decide to have someone on staff full-time to do them. But just know these things are all out there for you. And they're just things you want to think about and plan for and put in your business plan. And kind of decide ahead of time. You know, okay, when I open and it's just me, I'm going to do the bookkeeping. But when I hit X amount, then I need to factor in a budget for a bookkeeper. There are a lot of trade organizations, as you probably already know, that are extremely helpful. The Brewers Association is amazing. I've learned so much from them and from the CBC conference, which is just, you know, like this conference, really, really helpful. There are state associations. Not every state has one, but certainly I think at some point they probably all will. California's is huge, as you can imagine. And I spoke to someone who said Nevada actually just had a meeting, maybe their first meeting, a couple weeks ago. And then there are local brewers' guilds. Those are really helpful as well. I mean, these are people who've already been down the road. They've done it. They've made these mistakes. Not all of them, hopefully, but they've, you know, they've been through the trenches. They can help you avoid what happened to them. Because there was nobody, some of these guys, there was nobody there to tell them what to watch out for. And then there's always the internet. Be careful about the internet. And I say that from a legal standpoint, as there's nothing wrong with the free information on the internet, but you just want to make sure you qualify the source. Make sure if it's legal stuff, if it's contracts, well, I'll just pull a contract off the internet. Well, make sure it's specific to your state. Make sure it addresses all the issues that you need to address. And the thing that is always a little scary is you don't know who wrote that. So, or I've had someone, oh, this brewery is going to give me their private placement memorandum. Like, okay, where did they get it from? Did they get it from a reputable attorney? Okay, sure. But if maybe they pulled it off the internet and it's written for New York's laws and you're in California or Nevada or Michigan. You know, you've just got to be very careful. And there's a lot of great free information, but just make sure you qualify it. Okay, this is really the last one, which is failing to continually adjust your business plan. You always want to be aware of where you're going. Where am I now? Where am I going? And adjust accordingly. Because most people that I end up talking to end up getting really big without realizing it. And they suffer a lot of growth pains because they weren't necessarily paying attention. And it's hard. You're so busy. You're doing 20 other things. And all you want to do is brew beer. But you got to do the payroll and the bookkeeping and deal with suppliers and, you know, deal with the bottling line. But you always want to be looking ahead. Always figure out where you are, where you're going, what's the next step, what do I need, and try and anticipate before you get there. So I've got one last video, if I can figure out how to make it play. Oh, there we go.
Good afternoon. So I'm doing this little video real quick for Candace Moon. She currently represents me, one of my brew houses, as well as some other legal entities that I have with the California California ABC, and then obviously the federal TTB. There's quite a few things that that I've learned over the course of the last, you know, 7 or 8 years dealing with these entities, is that you need to have people on your team that that understand it a lot better than you do. the pitfalls and the gaps in information and the information flow and the clarity in the information that you have is just completely atrocious. So it's very difficult for you to understand this unless you're in a legal setting and or you're just brilliant. I believe that everything from my formation of my entities was something that was that I understood pretty well. But some of the things like keeping your meeting minutes, just as one example, it's something that, you know, if you're just a small corporation, it's just you, but you still have to maintain this level of business integrity. Lots of securities laws that kind of plague you from time to time. I think there's things like undercapitalization that you always don't understand how much money you really need. You think, well, you get a quote from Premier Stainless or whatever to get your brew house, and you say, well, I've got that, and then, you know, well, you need a lot more money to do that. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. Also understanding, you know, what's the local, state, and federal regulations. They're changing all the time. They're very complicated, and you know, understanding, you know, whatever your this particular regulation or legislation is complicated to the layman. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I believe trademarking, you know, and understanding, you know, that's an important piece. You have a great beer, you have a great product, and then somebody, you know, you don't protect yourself, and somebody's using that wonderful name, and maybe that's one shot to make it. So there's lots of different resources that are available, but I think, you know, some of the major mistakes that people will find, and I've had troubles in myself, is just, you know, being prepared in the beginning. That's going to set everything up. So having these resources available to you while you're doing it, so you can learn before you make the mistake. No one wants to get levied with a huge fine. No one wants to be their business potentially be shut down. Auditors come in because you're not keeping proper books. Your corporation is in jeopardy. All these things are really critical, and I think that's why it's important to have somebody you know, on retainer that you can go to and says, "Help me out with these particular important pieces of information." You know, and 8 years into this business, I would think that I would have a good handle and command on what I'm doing, but still, I am surprised month to month. I'm still learning about things that I might not be doing as well as I could be, and that's scary. Okay, thanks.
There we go. So that was Scott Blair. He is the owner of Hamilton's Tavern in San Diego, which is actually where I worked during law school. And then he opened a brewery a few years ago called Monkey Paw. So, takeaway. Okay. Think of three of those areas, even when you open your brewery, that you're going to need help with. And then who can help you with those needs? There are a lot of attorneys out there. There are a lot of attorneys that are actually specializing, like I do, in craft beer. There's not a ton, but there's more every day. I get the phone calls. How did you do that? That's so cool. And if there's not a brewery-specific person in your area, a small business attorney can handle all the business stuff. Someone who's had some experience with manufacturing is ideal. And then there's definitely alcohol beverage attorneys in just about every state. I've definitely done the research to get a network. But there's definitely people to help you. Firms are going to be more expensive than solo practitioners. That's just across the board. But the information's out there. I think I have just a few minutes. 3 minutes for questions. I apologize for going over. If anyone has a question, there's a microphone up here, and then I'm around the rest of the day if anyone wants just to grab me. So any official questions?
Real quick, how does Kickstarter play into, like, Regulation D?
Getting a good question. So Kickstarter, by the way, is not equity. Kickstarter is free money. So it's taxable. And it's literally just giving you money. So it has nothing to do with securities. So you can run a Kickstarter campaign. You know, you sell a glass for $50. You're making $49, basically. And you pay taxes on it. That's how Kickstarter... They're looking to do Kickstarter crowdfunding, but I don't think they've figured out how to do that yet with the securities laws, which is why you haven't seen it yet. Okay, looks like we got another one.
In talking about copyrights, can you copyright like a blog or a persona?
You can definitely copyright a blog. I don't know if you can copyright a persona or not, per se. You could trademark a persona. You got it. Anybody else? Thank you very much. If you oh, wait, we got one guy coming. That's what happens when you sit in the back.
If you're attempting to put together a business, one guy has the money, one guy has the equipment, one guy has the sweat equity. How do you divide what their return is on that?
Honestly, it's up to you. You basically decide, you make the three of you would make a decision of what's worth what. And how many hours is someone going to put in versus, and you just put a dollar value to it. You literally can just decide. There's no legal guidelines.
Okay.
And you can, the question is, can you assign stock on that basis? You certainly can. There's a number of different ways you could set that up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the AHA, we'd like to give Candace Moon another big hand for coming out and doing her talk. Thank you very much.